about the traffic in Los Angeles. It says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want to just go all the way to the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home. Across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you could even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go down Fairs, another tier, and about 5 minutes, we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
The freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
An MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line. There's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast a tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard.
Los Angeles! There's too many people! I want them to go away! Even though it means he's afraid!
Too Many People could also be a motto for It's Casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with freeways, with people, or his native LA. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's Casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-10, the freeway, but that's so nice. The red light, 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 the red light. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The 605, the 101, the 101, the 101, the I-10, the 210, the 605, the 101, the 405, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light. The red light, 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 the red light.
Good afternoon, good afternoon. Welcome to the 112th episode of Los Angeles Nista. This is the NAMM 2014 wrap-up, and I am the show creator, producer, and host, Edward Solis. Thank you for joining us. We have interviews that were conducted at NAMM 2014 in Anaheim, California, from Bill from Macedon and Fredo Ortiz from BC Boys and Bongoloids. And my in-studio guest is the mystery man, the man behind the van that everybody took pictures with at NAMM, and it's still floating around in cyberspace, the founder of Vagina Guitars. It's Andrew Miller. How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. The founder of Vagina Guitars. Here you are. You created such a huge, gigantic splash of photography and social networking at NAMM 2014. I know for a fact, coming from the music business, that nobody could buy that. I'm not sure if it's a strategy, but I'm just going to say you did it. It's out there, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you. It was actually completely unexpected. My wife had heels on. We had to park close. And I drive that van every day, so.
That's your van. Now, let's talk about your company, Vagina Guitars. Let's go back. Okay, when did you commit to doing your own company?
It was about a year and a half ago. I was looking for a baritone guitar, and everything I found, I just didn't like.
Okay.
And there was a time when I lived in Asia. I went to some trade shows out there and ended up finding some people in Korea that would build what I draw. So I started just drawing different things. Send me this, send me that, send me this. And then I'd put in American hardware and stuff. And I realized it was just as good as everything else I found. So I started selling it. And of course, when it came to the name, it was the first thing that came to mind. I wanted a guitar that said vagina on it. I thought it was funny.
And it's simple as that. That's the message behind it, or that's how it happened.
Yeah, pretty much.
And then you made the van.
Yeah. Well, basically, you got to work with what you got. I always see people driving around with these vans that have these, like, really busy stickers. You can't even tell what they're selling. There's so much stuff on it. It's like beef and, like, a couple of guys shirtless, and you don't even know what it is.
Too much stuff, right?
Yeah, so I just made sure it was just two words, you know, and .com, and you can tell what it is. And people do know what it is because they're taking pictures of me on a freeway all the time, swerving next to me in my blind spot. Yeah, it's definitely interesting.
Okay. Let's talk about your guitars that you have, and you are going to be releasing. Let's talk about the shapes. You could start one by one.
I'm starting with classic styles. I have a single cut that comes two different ways. You can have it standard length, standard 24.75 inches. That's the same as like a Les Paul. I have that, and then I have the baritone version, which I like. I have a... I don't know what you call it. I guess I could say SG style, but no affiliation with Gibson, of course. That only comes in baritone, and I have some Vs coming out. I really wish I had more Vs made because they're just blowing up. I get so many requests for the Vs, it's not even funny.
Is that the most requested, you think, from you?
Yeah, everybody wants a flying vagina.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been getting hit up so much. I originally made 39 guitars, and I was telling my wife, like, I hope we can sell 5 of these if we park the van here. And now I'm like, you know what? I got to get more stuff. I just need more stuff. So we're scrambling to find money, basically, because it's hard to, you know, fund stuff when it's just a family business.
Right. Let's talk about the guitar without the volume knob.
I made that for myself because it's basically an FU guitar, you know?
I love that.
Yeah, I don't need it. It's like, whatever. I'm not turning it down anyway. First, it started with no tone because I always have it in the same spot. So I was like, I don't need this thing. And everybody these days has the 15-channel amp anyway. So, yeah, forget all that stuff. Just volume pedal, 7 distortions. It's fine.
There you go. Right. There you go. Now, personally, you are making... I've never played a baritone guitar, but you're making them.
Yeah, well, I like to tune low. Right. I started buying guitars and tuning low, and it's... And, well, I started seeing it online because I'm searching for it. And I realized they all look like slightly off. Like it's, I don't know, like a birth defect or something when you see a
as far as being balanced?
Yeah, they just look funny. You know, it's not a bass, not a guitar. So I try to keep it the same actual length as a regular guitar, but then have the actual string length from bridge to nut is much larger. So it's like 28 inches. I got an extra 4 inches or 3.5 inches on there. And the tone is completely different. The low notes ring out. It's not quite a bass, but I find myself playing them as like a bass. I can't help it. But I like low. I like low, distorted, and angry.
Now, as far as the next phase, I mean, you obviously created a demand for yourself.
Yeah, a bigger demand than I expected. So
it's a good problem to have, though.
Yeah, it's not a bad problem.
It's not a bad problem.
But it is a bad problem when you're trying to get a business loan in your company's name, Vagina.
Is that a problem?
A little bit, yeah. The people who understand. But the people who don't just look at you
crazy. They really don't understand. Yeah, they look at you like, what are you up to?
But then that just makes me think of another slogan. It's like, hey, Vagina. Some people get it.
You're only here once a week, right?
What do you mean?
That's a joke because you're making these funny jokes. And I was like, this guy's like a professional comedian.
No, I just talk too much.
Oh, no, you don't. No, you don't.
So, actually, I do.
So what were you thinking when you were inside the van and you saw people taking photos against your van?
Well, we got there early because living in LA, we know how the traffic is.
The freeways are not so nice, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we headed out early. My wife didn't even have her makeup on or anything. I said, just do it there. So we get there, we park. She starts doing her makeup, and all of a sudden, it was like zombies. People are just walking up, and they're leaning against the van, and we're like, whoa, what is this? Because this is like, I don't know, 7:30 in the morning on Thursday, and it pretty much went on from 7:30 in the morning until at least 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
All 4 days. I mean, as soon as we saw our friends, you know, the first day, someone inside said, you know you can't drive home, right? You can't move that thing. You need to go get a rental car and just leave that thing there because you can't buy that. Like you said earlier, you can't buy that and you also can't plan it. We had no idea.
So let's talk about all the buzz throughout NAMM and post with all the social networking that has happened with your brand. You have friends worldwide, a friend in Prague saying, what are you doing over there?
Yeah. My buddy, I had a friend who knew I started the company and basically he starts seeing things from, cause he's been a professional guitarist forever. He starts seeing, posts on his Facebook from other people. And he's like, yeah, what's happening? Because it's blowing up my webpage and none of it's from you. And I know you don't even know these people. Some of them are in Brazil but that's what it was. It spread really fast.
That's killer. That's killer. So tell me, what is going to be your goal for this year?
My goal for this year is to open a store on Sunset Boulevard.
And it's going to say?
It'll say Vagina as big as I can possibly afford to pay for a sign.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now,
I wanted like the size of the Ralph sign. Yeah, about like that.
We're going to get into one of our pre-recorded interviews that we conducted over at NAMM. It's with Bill, one of the guitarists from Mastodon. And before we do that, I wanted to ask you, did you find NAMM to be as productive as you thought it would be for you, going to find hardware vendors, et cetera?
It was. Because, see, I had the guitars made, and I still have to do my part. So I have, like, half-finished guitars being shipped to me from Korea.
Okay.
But what was funny was, when I originally tried to register with companies as a wholesaler, they would give me a hard time because of the company name.
So you're being discriminated, basically.
Basically, yeah. I mean, but what happened was when I started, I figured I'd talk to them in person, you know, go to NAMM, talk to them in person, and it'd be easier. But what happened was by the second, third day, I would walk up to the people's booths and talk to them. They'd look at my badge and they go, oh, hey, you want to see a picture with your van? So it made it a lot easier. It broke the ice. People realized it wasn't some guy in a company. I mean, excuse me, some guy in a basement with one guitar trying to get pickups for cheap.
Right.
It made it a lot easier. But at the same time, it got me sidetracked where a couple of the days I didn't even get to look at anything because people kept stopping me and my wife. You know, like, hey, is that you? Is that you? Where's your booth? Where's your booth? And we didn't have one because we didn't even plan on it. I wish I did, though, because we would have probably made the money for the booth in shirts.
There you go.
Yeah,
so there you go. Okay. So we're going to listen to this interview that Los Angeles Nista and SkidRowStudios.com conducted at NAMM 2014 with Bill from Mastodon. Okay. Welcome to Los Angeles Nista with Eddie Solis. This is the NAMM coverage episode, NAMM 2014 in Anaheim, California. And my guest standing right here in front of me is Bill Kelleher.
Yep.
Okay. So, Bill, I want to talk to you specifically about the coherent mission statement of NAMM, which is actually the National Association of Music Merchants. It's all about, you know, new product being manufactured, buyers from stores coming to purchase it, and revealing new product lines. And it even gets deeper into curriculum with, you know, teachers and music schools. I want to ask you, prior to your success in Macedon, did you ever come to NAMM before this?
No, I've never came to NAMM before Macedon. I don't think I really even knew about it back then, you know. I was never really on the radar enough. I mean, I never took any guitar lessons, like, my whole life. Until recently, I actually called a guy up and said, hey, would you mind coming over and giving me a lesson? And he was a local guy, and it was right around April Fool's Day. He thought I was kidding with him. I was like, no, I really... It was before we did the Crack the Sky record, and I was like, man, I really need... I should probably take a lesson. I've never taken one, you know, because I don't know anything about theory. I mean, you know, I know enough to play and to write, but I was always been a songwriter. So NAMM never came on in the radar for me. I mean, I've been playing since I was 15, and I'm 40, almost 43 now. So, you know, it's been a few years, but I just learned by ear, you know, putting on old Metallica records and Slayer, you know.
Killer. So that was your foundation for guitar playing as far as metal guitar playing.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so let's talk about your pickup through Lace. Now, you actually have your own signature pickup. Talk about how you chose to design it and the sound you're trying to get out of it.
Well, you know, I've learned that you know, less is more sometimes, you know, and I always used to go with really super hot pickups because I only really played one style of music, which was super. I wanted the heavier the better, you know. And when you're a kid, you can't afford those nice amps like the nice Marshalls that have, like, you know, a cleaner tone, or, you know, they have, you know, can do more, you know, with the gain knobs and stuff like that. You know, when I was a kid, I just wanted distortion pedals and the heaviest stuff I could get, because the amps that my dad had bought me back in the day, the Trainers and the old Yamahas and stuff, they were like jazz amps. So I never thought about that an amp could, you didn't need the pickup to always be so damn hot. So as I grew and got older and more mature and started, you know, man, making more money and finding better amps, and, you know, I started buying old Marshalls that, you know, can give a good amount of, you know, clean tones with a, you know, pedal. And, you know, I was using, you know, distortion pickups, super high gain. And when the band started to write a little more in a different direction with clean stuff, I found that I was stuck. Like, I couldn't get those clean tones that I wanted to get. I'd have to take off my distortion pedal, turn the gain down in the amp. So I was like, this amp is going to be, sounds great without the distortion pedal. I can crank the gain up. So maybe it's in my pickup. Maybe it's in the speakers. Maybe the speakers don't need to be, you know, 75 watt or whatever. I can bring those down a little bit to break up easier, and I don't have to rely so much on just having this crazy high output pickup because it's squealing and making all this noise. So when my signature guitar was made, I wanted the... When Lace came to me, first of all, backtrack a little bit. When Lace first came to me, Jared Reynolds was just nonstop, like, you got to try these pickups. Calling me once a week. I was like, this guy's really bothering me. He's like, on the verge of... I know he's trying to be nice, but you know what? Finally, I gave in. I said, let me try these things out. I put them in my guitar, and I was like, these sound like an EMG with soul, but no batteries. So I was like, this sounds great. So I went for pretty much the first pickup he gave me was the Lace Nitro Hemi, which is very high gain output pickup. And I put it in my Les Paul, 77 Les Paul Custom, which still sits in there today. And that was a couple years ago. And it just sounds amazing. Even for clean stuff, it sounded good too. When I took off the distortion pedal, it just quieted right down and got nice and clean. My definition of clean is different than maybe some other guitar players, but basically, when he kept telling me, you need to make your own pickup and design your own pickup. And I was like, well, how do I make this pickup? Already sounds awesome. How do I make it sound more awesome? So I thought, why don't I take the gain down, the high output down a little bit, and, you know, give it a little bit more of a tight bottom end. And honestly, like, when I first toured with Alice in Chains and Jerry Cantrell, you know, he was playing, and he always had his amps totally isolated backstage. So you'd just be walking down the hall, they'd be playing on stage, no amps on stage, but his cabinets would be mic'd up behind the stage. So you could walk right up to the amp and just hear every freaking note. And I was blown away. I was like, what the hell is he using? I want that sound, because it was just a light, you know, drizzle of distortion in there, but it sounded so chunky when he meet palm mutes and plays solos, all that stuff. And I was like, how do I design a pickup that sounds, can do all that stuff, you know, or close to that, you know? So of course I went to his guitar tech, where I went to Jerry first, you know, he's like, oh, well, I use these Friedman amps. So I bought a Friedman amp. He's like, well, we use these Motor City pickups. I'm like, I need those. And, you know, I did that combination. So when talking to Jared at Lace, you know, I was like, well, maybe I can base it kind of off that sound, you know, and that's not that I'm trying to steal Jerry's sound.
That was your foundation.
But that was kind of the starting point. Yeah, I was like, Jerry's sound is amazing. My sound's a little bit different, but I like where it's going, like the AC/DC crunch and chunk, but just a little bit more gain. A little bit more, because they have great sounding guitars, and the high strings ring out. That's what I like. I want to hear those high strings. A lot of guitar players, you know, they scoop the mids, and I did that for years until I realized you listen to recordings of you live, and there's no, where are you? You're gone. You're muddied, muffled. It sounds great up close. If you're just sitting in your room practicing, it sounds great, but for me, I started to experiment turning that, you know, mids up, and flattening the EQ and starting to experiment with sounds like that. So I said, let's put some more mids in this pickup. Let's make the bottom end nice and tight. I don't want any like flabby resonance coming out. I want
more definition, right?
I want more definition. I want, when I stop playing, I want pickup to react. When I palm mute something, I don't want any mud. I want it defined with just enough distortion to give me a pick squeal, you know, when I want to pinch harmonic or something. So we went back and forth for about 3-4 weeks, Jeff Lace and I, and, you know, I had my my array of pickups that I thought sounded great, you know, between the Gibsons, the Bare Knuckles, the Motor City, all great pickups, but I, you know, I'm trying to design my own with a little bit of each one in there.
Sure.
So I spent, you know, day and night taking pickups in and out and going down the practice room and plugging it into different amps and seeing what I liked about each pickup that Jeff Lace had sent me, and being totally honest and just saying, hey, like, this one doesn't work for me. It doesn't have the bottom end tightness that I want. And we started getting, I was like, it's getting warmer. It's getting closer. I mean, a lot of people think I just took the Nitro Hemi and just added something or took something away, but I didn't. You know, we pretty much started from scratch, because I asked him, I said, how close in your specs is this pickup to the Nitro Hemi? And he's like, oh, it's completely different. He's like, he has like the spec sheets. I'm going to show you the spec sheet, and it's completely, like when he designed it, you know, he'd be crossing things out that I didn't like and adding K's here and whatever. I know nothing about that aspect of it. I just used my ear and tried to get as close to the sound that I thought would, you know, be an overall. Because I don't want to be just known for like, okay, there's Bill Kelleher's pickup is only for straight up Mastodon sound or metal. You know, it's, you can roll off, you can lower the pickup, and there's a lot less gain, and you can get more, still has that bite. Like the bite and crunch and sustain are the most important things, you know. And definition, you know, you gotta be able to, when you're playing a million notes, you know, you want to hear all that stuff.
Right, well put. So in the reality is, the way you articulated this is the whole pickup concept that you came up with. I mean, you started from scratch. There's no there's no borrowing of any ideas as a blueprint. I mean, it's just completely starting from scratch, adding, taking away until you got it right. If someone comes up to you and asks you, what's your favorite guitar for that pickup, through what amp, what would you say?
Well, I've got a 1987 Gunmetal Les Paul Custom that it's in right now. I only have one of them, but it'll probably go in more guitars. And I'm running that into my Friedman Brown Eye 100 that's modified, has a modified clean channel, and that's going through the Friedman cabinets, 2/4-12s, which are loaded with the 65 Creambacks Celestians, and man, it sounds, it's pretty close to godly to me. It sounds really good. You know, when I was designing the pickups also, I would send him, like, songs. Like, what did I send him? Like, Ride the Lightning. Like, you hear that, like, definition of the guitars. I mean, they're very trebly, but I've always been a fan of the early Metallica 80s sound.
Absolutely.
I just said, hear that? You hear, like, guitar? You can hear the guitars. You can hear every little fucking note, pick, and, like, everything. I want that. That's what I want.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's funny. I think a lot of those old Metallica records, as you say, are more key to metal music than people realize, as far as deep as their tones and the aura that those records create. I mean, you're absolutely right about that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about your Gibson.
Okay.
When you started playing guitar, did you ever think you would have your own Gibson?
Never. I didn't even think I'd own my own Gibson. I mean, as a kid, I was, up until my late 20s, I didn't have enough money really to even buy more than one guitar at a time. My very first guitar, actually, I saved up was a white Gibson Explorer. I think it was like $600, brand new, back in 91, 92. And I was I was head over heels over that guitar. And of course, I bought it because I loved Metallica and James Hetfield and everything that they were doing. And I always knew I wanted to be a musician and play music for a living, but to have my own signature model, I mean, it took work. It wasn't just, I'm not like Slash or
right. I mean, the music industry is different. The MTV, Guns N' Roses, it takes a lot of work to, a lot of components to get your own signature model. It just didn't happen.
No. I had to pursue them and call them and bother them because they promised me at one point they would do it. And then some things got rattled at Gibson and some people weren't sure if they're going to have their jobs anymore and management switching around things. So they kind of put me on hold for a while, but I got right back in there. I think it was actually 2 years ago at NAMM when I met one of my good friends over there who works in the New York office, Jim Felber, pointed me in the right direction. He said, you need to talk to that guy over there. He works in Nashville. He can get you what you want done. So I walked right up to him. He's like, of course, let's get working on it now. And I followed up and I just kept on the horn with him and sent him an emails and made a good relationship with those guys. And anytime they asked me to do anything, I'm like, of course, what do you want me to do? Like, oh, we're going to send you to Sweetwater to do a little clinic. We're going to send you over here to talk about us, Some kind of like their poster child at the moment, so I'm enjoying it.
Very cool. Now let's talk about your signature. Let's talk about the body.
Mm-hmm. Well, the body is modeled after like early 1980s E2s, the Explorer E2, which was a really big, thick, heavy guitar, which I have a collection of them, back home, and I've been slowly buying them up. And then, they're basically not as, they're just rounder. They're more classic looking than the sharper Explorers like from the 80s and 90s or late 80s and 90s where they started getting the sharp kind of tail fin. And, so I wanted it to be rounder because they sent me a couple prototypes and said, it's got to be round. It's got to be look a little more, curvy. Like a woman's body.
Well, yeah, men like their guitars curvy like they like their women, right?
Exactly. So, I wanted that, first of all, and, the color scheme of the paint. Because, I'm mostly a Silverburst playing guy, guitar-wise. And I Brendan had beat me to it. Me and Brendan went on tour together, and we both had the same Tobacco Sunburst E2s, and we were, showing, cock sizes to each other. Oh, yeah, well, this is mine, this is yours, okay, cool. And, he was talking about Gibson going to make him a guitar, and I was saying, oh, they're going to make me one too, and he sent them a black and white photo of the same Tobacco guitar, and they said, oh, Silverburst, huh? And he's like, yeah, sure, so he beat me to that. But then I thought, well, how about Goldburst? Or, I was thinking gold. I saw, is it Lizzie Hellstrom? She had one made by Gibson. And when I saw her having one, I said, now she's got one. Where's mine? I need one, So I looked at hers, and I saw the trapezoid inlays. And I've always thought trapezoid inlays should be on every guitar you play because it just makes it look that much classier. And I hadn't seen them on an Explorer before. So I said, yeah, put trapezoid inlays on there, the old school body shape. Let's move, I want to make a little difference. So let's move the toggle switch being way over here and then, way down in the horn of the the front of the guitar. You have to reach all the way across the strings to activate it, which, you know, I thought being over here would be a little closer to home, being closer to the bridge. And, you know, having three or four knobs, and they always put the volume in the center, and I just didn't, I never understood that. I'm used to hitting it on my old guitars, turning it out, turning off the volume when you're done with a song, but I was like, why would you put the volume in the middle? At least make it the first one. And then I was like, why do we need three knobs at all? How about we just put three into two?
Less is more.
Less is more, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not rocket science, I'm a scientist. I need a couple knobs, give me one knob, whatever. So it also has push-pull coil splitting, which I figured, you know, sometimes when you're in the studio, if you're a kid, you only own one guitar and you're in the studio and the guy says, do you have another guitar to use for a different sound? Well, no, I don't. Well, you can split the coil and at least get a little bit of a different sound there. If you're doing a lead or you're doing something clean, you've got options. You don't just have the one pickup and the one sound. So that's another thing I changed on it. And the name Golden Axe just kind of came to me.
Killer.
An old Sega game that I used to play at Time Out at the mall, like, you know.
So Time Out was a chain.
Yeah, mall, and I was a mall rat.
There is one here in L.A. at Stonewood Mall. I thought that was the only one. Fun fact.
Fun facts.
So that guitar looks like it weighs a ton. Do you know how much it weighs?
I don't know. It's probably 7 or 8 pounds. I'm not sure. It does weigh a lot. I don't want to. I don't believe in. What do you call it?
Cheaping out.
Yeah, cheaping out. I mean,
well, that's great that it weighs a lot, because the resonation is probably just.
Yeah, when they hollow out the inside, they chamber it. Like, I'm like, don't chamber my guitar. No way. Why would you do that? Oh, to make it lighter. Why would you make it lighter? Yeah.
Make it as heavy as.
That's part of the deal. You're playing heavy music, heavy guitar.
Make it heavy. Yeah. I have a E2 that probably weighs 15 pounds. That thing is so fucking heavy, and I hand it to people, and they're just like, ooh, Jesus.
They're not ready for it.
It's like this thick. It's great, and I love it, and I play it, you know, as much as I can. I jump around on stage with it. That's why I'm so strong.
You're a strong, manly man, right?
That's right.
Okay, let's talk about Macedon.
Okay.
Okay, you guys are working on a new album right now.
Yes, we are, and we're up in Nashville with Nick Raskolenix. That's a mouthful of words.
So he's back home. That's
yeah. Yeah, he is, and we're there recording, and we're about 80% there, I think, with the record. We're putting down vocals. I got to go back there and do my final guitar stuff and, you know, little noises and things like that, the soundscapes that'll go in between songs and whatnot. And then we're going to start mixing early next month. And then we're off to Australia for Soundwaves Festival. And I just got back from Australia, New Zealand, Japan with my other band called Primate, which we did a 3-week tour over there. So I'm headed right back. It's, you know, I'll go home for a minute, kiss my kids, and then back on the road.
Really cool. Now, the Primate thing, let's talk about that. I know I've seen you guys a couple of times, and it was refreshing to know, not only I knew you came from hardcore roots and appreciated it, but actually doing a new band like that, you know, like when you had on your extra time, how did that come together?
I think I just had some downtime with Mastodon and Kevin Sharp and the rest of the guys asked me to come in and, you know, kind of just do a little, do some demoing, because I have a small studio back in Atlanta, and I said, yeah, I'll record your stuff. I'm just getting my feet wet in doing that. And once we, I found out I started like producing a little bit, because I was like, hey, why don't you play that riff some more? That's an awesome riff. And the songs were like 20 seconds long. And I'm like, man, you got to revisit that riff. It's too good to not, you know? So they're like, well, show us. Here, take a guitar. I'm like, hey, like this. So then they're like, why don't you just play too? And then, yeah, this is kind of how it was born. We don't really practice or jam maybe once a week. And then we tour like maybe twice a year. But it's kind of, you know, it's just something fun to do. It's playing really fast, and I get to play some leads and some solos, and Kevin screams, and it's just a totally different thing than Mastodon. Mastodon's is like my business job, and this is like my fun job, you know what I mean? I mean, Mastodon's fun too.
Of course, but why would you do two bands that sound the same?
Exactly, yeah.
So let's talk about the album cycle. I mean, what you guys are doing, I mean, this will be a new album, a tour, video. Let's talk about the videos. You guys have always done great videos, especially with Crack the Sky. Those are some of my favorite. Do you think you'll be using the same director, Robo Shobo, for that?
I don't know. You know, we're so day-to-day. We don't really think that far in advance with the videos, but I think so. I really like his work. I like working with the guy. He's great, and he's got a good vision, but I don't know. I mean, this record's totally taken a different direction as well, artwork-wise, and... you know, just sound-wise, too, it's a lot different than our last record, so.
And lastly, before we go, who's your favorite Black Flag singer?
Favorite Black Flag singer? It's got to be Keith Morris.
All right. All right. Well,
welcome,
thank you so much,
NAM
Bill.
Edition
of Los Angeles.
Thanks,
Eddie. I'm 2014. I'm Edward Solis. And here, representing all the percussionists and drummers here at NAM, is Fredo Ortiz, a well-rounded individual who has worked with Beastie Boys, Offspring, Money Mark Band, many more. Currently has a ton of projects to talk about and his own band, Bongaloids. Fredo, how are you?
I'm good, brother. How are you, Eddie?
I'm good. Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Thank you, man. Just over here running around at NAM.
Let's talk about your first NAM experience. How old were you?
I was probably about 16 or 17. I went with one of my best friends, Louis Perez. And he says, hey, my dad's going to this thing in Anaheim. You want to go? There's a bunch of instruments. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. He's like, but shoot, we need a badge for you. But here, you're going to be Robert Tovar for today.
For today.
So I put on this badge as I was Robert Tovar.
And that was before they checked IDs at the door.
Exactly. You know, and we walked in, and, you know, I was young enough, probably didn't care about gear as much, but when I walked in, it was like total candy store, you know, and we just kind of followed his dad, and his dad had to do, like, all these little, you know, meetings and stuff like that, and we just kind of ran off and did our thing. But I didn't, that was first NAM. That was my experience. And didn't really, you know, soak in the fact that I was here, you know, looking at new products or, you know, looking for people to represent me as a player. I was just, you know, I was 16, 17.
It was about being here, and it was like you said, being a kid in a candy store.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about the dynamic of coming in, not as experienced, to coming while you're in the BC Boys. Let's talk about that dynamic. Now, there's a lot of people that endorsed you and still do. It is work when you come now, isn't it?
Definitely a lot of work. It's a lot of, you know, for one thing, they're here to exhibit their new products. To the players, but more to people who are going to distribute and sell their product. But as a player and musician, you know, you come in and you see what's new. And you know, for me, I didn't get into looking at endorsements till after, you know, I had toured with the Beastie Boys for a couple of years. They had their own endorsements, so I kind of just came into a built-in system where, here are the drums you're going to play. These are cool, right? And I'd be like, yeah, that's cool. The first year that I actually did get to choose what I wanted was 2007. It was the mix-up tour for the Beastie Boys. And, you know, the person that usually dealt with the connection with all the companies wasn't there anymore. So I had to, like, call myself and go, hey, what's going on? I'm touring with the Beastie Boys. They're like, sure, what do you need? And the deal that the Beastie Boys has, they would buy the product and they would own it. So I really didn't get the endorsement just yet, but I did get to choose what I wanted. It wasn't until after that I finally said, hey, I should go check this out. I should go talk to these companies, since I am representing, you know, a band that's well-known around the world. And, you know, that usually helps with them wanting to help you out with their gear. So I went to all these companies. I went to Pearl, went to Zildjian. Zildjian was a big sponsor of the Beastie Boys. You know, Vic Firth as well. Vic Firth came in through when I was playing in a band called Morningwood from New York, you know, and I was just like, I tried these sticks. Now they make me, you know, signature sticks. Zildjian, Kirsten at Zildjian, you know, great deal, great people. They're all great people. And, you know, it's like, you know, you don't come here to expect anything for free. It kind of seems like the thing, like, oh, you know, I represent a band. There's so many bands here in LA. Like, how do you just expect to get something for free? You got to work at that too. You got to be able to be the one to go out and talk to these people, you know, tell them what you're about, say that you're willing to, you know, use their product. But in the end, you know, you have their guitar, you have their drums, you have their microphone that you're using, because that's what you've used all along since you were a kid. I went to Guitar Center and bought Remo drum heads, and, you know, so we supported these companies all along. And then now here we are, you know, older, you're part of a touring band and they want to help you out. And so now I come here to say hello, represent, take pictures, you know, and then look for the new stuff, see what's going on, and then, you know, want to use that and go, hey, like, you know, now that I'm playing guitar in a band, you know, and I was just in the Gibson booth, you know, I met a couple of people there, you know, so it's like, you know, I'm going out there, and you have to do the footwork yourself, you know.
Right. Yeah, I think that's the business model for the music industry more than ever. The infrastructure is what you build.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, as far as the people that you work with, as far as manufacturers, who do you work with as far as sponsorships and endorsements for drums or percussion?
Well, the cool one was going with Pearl Drums, because they also have a percussion department. And I was doing both. With Beastie Boys, I was playing congas, timbales, tambourine, shaker, whatever. I was the auxiliary percussion. And not till 2007 did I get to play drums for them. So now I was Beastie Boy punk drummer and percussionist. So when I went with Pearl, they had the best of both worlds. You know, I love all the other companies. It's funny because you end up using every other company because every company has something that you can use. So how is it, you know, it's hard to like live for just one company, you know, but you do it. Yeah. So I signed up with them and they were cool. They gave me a great drum set. They gave me a set of timbales, you know, and I've been able to use it on television. You know, they gave me they were making Japanese taiko drums. And, you know, I did a Jimmy Kimmel show, you know. So it was like stuff like that. When you're able, you know, I know with people like kids who are in bands starting out, you know, and they want to be at that level, it's just you got to just push hard and be in it. You got to be in the game for a long time, you know, to actually, you know, gain these perks too.
It just doesn't come to you. I mean, it's definitely building a foundation, building off that foundation and being a work in progress.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Now, as far as sticks, let's talk about your sticks.
Sticks, Vic for sticks, you know, they're, I've used their sticks since I was real young, and that was something I think that was what I was saying earlier. I was like, I went to the companies that I was already using their product and liked it. And when I went to them, and you know, with the help of having the Beastie Boys and you know my resume, you know, is one thing, and they said yes, come on in, you know. And I, you know, the deal is sweet, you know, because when I'm not working, you know, I could get a little bit of discount. When I'm working, they provide, you know, for your job. You're going out for 6 months, dude, here, supply, you know. When you're not working, you know, they also take care of me, you know. And they do every, you know, for mallets, because I have a marimba at home, they do mallets, they do beaters. I was in marching band, you know, they do everything.
Awesome.
You know, so it's like, and then I have recently got a Bongaloids Fredo, you know, signature stick. So then, you know, they'll print my name on it, you know. And it's cool, man. It's such a pleasure to have that connection with the company, you know. And
that's great. I mean, you have your own sticks. That's pretty cool.
Sticks, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Lars Ulrich does, and so does Fredo Ortiz.
There you go. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, since like when I was touring in 98, that was the world tour. And that's what these companies look for, is that you're going to be out there, you know, displaying their product, you know,
on some platform.
And you know, and I didn't do that. I didn't go after that, maybe because of where I was in life or, you know, the age. Like, it really didn't concern me that much until later, where I was just like, oh shit, you know, I keep buying this stuff, I should probably be able to go in and see if I can, you know, strike a deal with them to see where I can still use their stuff and not have to pay as much, because I am using it all the time, and you know, and I'm working, I'm out there, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it's so funny because it seems like you know, a lot of people now talking about, say, when I say a lot of people, I mean a local band that maybe has a little bit of a buzz in general, you know, they that aren't really experienced think that they're entitled to these endorsements and don't realize, as we stated earlier, that it's, you got to have a solid foundation built for yourself and touring and making records and the visibility. And it's even though you had the opportunity to be a part of the BC Boys and tour on that level in front of all those people, it's all about longevity and consistency. Yeah, it doesn't always have to be on that level. I mean, if you could provide a good product for them, records, pictures,
exactly,
you know, in different scenarios, in the studio, video games. I mean, you do everything. I mean, you do a lot of work for video games as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
let's talk about that.
Yeah, I just got done working with Woody Jackson over at Vox Studios in Hollywood, and we worked on the soundtrack for Grand Theft Auto V. We had a team of, you know, 20 musicians that were rotating in and out of the studio, and Woody was capturing it all, had the ideas, you know, we're doing like the funk tracks, and I came in as a drummer and a percussionist, did mostly percussion, but drummers like Joey Waronker, you know, big name people were coming through to play on this thing. And I had a buddy, this guy Danny Chedwig, and he was my partner on percussion, you know. And so we had two percussionists, you know, we had all this stuff. And I mean, you know, since we're talking about gear and stuff, like I look at our gear and on the floor and it's all mixed up, it's all like stuff from like Africa, you know. You find your own parts as a percussionist, you know. And but huge selling game. You know, we just did a live performance.
The biggest.
I mean, it's crazy. We just did a live performance of that soundtrack for the VGX Awards, the Video Game Awards. And they had a performance outside in downtown L.A. We backed up the game, Tyler, the creator. There's all these hip-hop artists that rhymed over these songs that we created in the studio and now is in a huge hit-selling game. You know, so it's, you know, I grateful and lucky that I still get these jobs, but I have... you know, been in this world long enough to where, you know, I have a lot of people that, you know, respect what I do as a musician and want me to be involved and, you know, and then I get to do it, you know.
That's really admirable. So let me ask you this. When you're in the studio making music for a video game, and the biggest video game in the world at that, I believe it is, yeah. Or one of the biggest, yeah. When you listen back, I mean, what's the feeling you get knowing that, like, people aren't going to be playing this in their car as far as listening to a record, but every kid in their living room is going to be playing this and hearing your music.
They're going to be hearing the music. And, you know, it's a trip because I was reading the message boards and people were like, oh, they're not using, you know, like licensed songs, or, you know, because there was all these, like, 80s songs. You could change the channel, you know, on the car. Now it's like, you know, some down-home, you know, just, you know, organically made music for a video game. And it's a trip to see their response to it. But yeah, mainly they're into the game, you know, and the music in the background is just kind of a filter, you know, it kind of keeps you interested, you know, and I lost my train of thought.
But what I wanted to ask was, that leads me to the next question. I mean, you front and lead your own band called Bongaloids. You play guitar and sing. As an independent artist that has created his own band and has taken the driver's wheel and been at the helm of leading the band with everything that it takes to do a band, video games are important. Because that equals music placement, and music placement equals money.
Definitely.
So what do you think as far as creating music, and then once it's done and recorded and released, taking avenues to get it placed?
I think if that's what you're looking for, then you definitely have chances to do that and get your music out there. For me, I've met a lot of people along the way, you know, working with the BC's Money Mark, you know, all these people that they all do that type of work. Money Mark scores movies and stuff like that, you know, so I've met a lot of these people, and now that I have my own record to promote, I get to hand them this record, and it's not going to guarantee me, you know.
But video games are important. It could be a platform.
You know, I mean, you look at, you know, all the skate videos, and I mean, all the skate... the video games, you know, you got the Bronx on there, you know, it's cool stuff. And those are all our friends, you know, so I was like, hey, you know, I think definitely I can, you know, be a candidate for that. And, you know, I try to listen to my music. Actually, I did think of movies and video games when I was making my record. Not necessarily that this is going to get placed on it, but I was just like, hey, you know, why not make something that you like, the sound that you like, and then maybe they'll like it too and put it in their video. You know?
Well done. Now, let's talk about you being a very, you know, a purist when it comes to percussions and all the sub percussions under the umbrella,
yeah.
And full kit, everything, and being having the experience you have playing with an act like BC Boys in arenas, in big halls, in theaters, in you know, stadiums around the world, being on that platform and even touring with Offspring. As far as that goes, and Money Mark was on some of those tours with the BC Boys. Being in that situation, behind the kit, and even in club situations with these major acts, and then now being out in front of the kit,
right?
Is that a different dynamic for you? I mean, how much of a comfort zone is it not?
It's definitely not a comfort zone for me because you're in the front, you know. You always make fun of the guy in front because he has to act crazy and be like he's got to entertain. And as a drummer, I'm behind my wall of drums. I'm protected, you know. I'm sitting down. And then, you know, that's what I grew up doing. That's what I know. That's from the back of my head.
That's a natural extension of you.
Natural extension, you know. And percussion came along because my dad was starting introducing me to even the music from Eddie Palmieri, Tito Puente, you know. So I knew what Latin music sounded like, and then he bought me those instruments, and I, you know, related the two, and I was like, oh, okay, this is what I gotta learn. But definitely, you know, playing and like the Offspring and all that, like they hired me as a percussionist, you know, and I was looking at their frontman. Money Mark, a keyboardist, wrote his own record and became a frontman. I was like, okay, well, let me see what this is like. Let me see what I can do with this. And definitely stepping out, putting on a guitar that, you know, I've jammed on my own in my bedroom. You know, I learned a couple bar chords when I was in the Villains from Louis and, you know, stuff like that. But I'm not a virtuoso guitar player. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, damn, I wrote these songs. Now I got to perform them. I had to step it up. I had to go back to school. I had to sit down and really learn my parts and then sing along to them. Be like, okay, I have a big responsibility now. Like, I've learned a new craft. I have to learn to be an entertainer. I have to learn to be someone who's going to communicate with the crowd now. Before, I didn't have to say anything. But I mean, after a while, I was the drummer with the mic, where you're like, ah, oh, who gave the drummer a mic? You know, nobody wants to hear the drummer talk. And it's like, you know, but I used to do backup vocals, you know, in most of the bands and stuff like that. So I kind of had, having that experience, you know, doing backup vocals for a punk band or anybody else, you know, gave me the confidence to try to sing, you know, up in front. And definitely it's a huge task to take. And, you know, you got to work at it like anything else. You got to work at it, you know.
And that was a point I was trying to articulate to all our listeners, is the fact that even though you've done so much percussion around the world on different levels, it's a natural extension of you, and you've had the you know, the ability and the, you know, being great enough to go out and be on the platforms with the Beastie Boys in these huge places, whether it's a stadium, an arena, a club, Money Mark or Offspring, and then, you know, whoever else at the time you were working with, you know, and play these venues that are in between. Yeah. It's kind of a thing, like, no matter how much experience you have by fronting your own band like you do now, it's like relearning something, right? Yeah. It takes work, energy, commitment.
Yeah.
And it's a new craft.
Yeah, and being used to, like, you know, playing arenas. And, you know, one thing that kept me grounded was having good friends at home that I can come back to. And I always, you know, playing at huge arenas, I would always come back home and play, like, you know, a pizza shop in Whittier called Ambrose. You know, it's like I'd go from traveling the world to playing that. So it's like, you know, doing that really humbled me to the point where it's like, you know, I felt comfortable doing this, you know.
Let's talk about your specs. What gauge are your sticks?
I use 5Bs, wood tip, and I don't use anything else. I use Zildjian Timbali sticks, which are actually the Luis Conte model, and then for, like, because I do different styles of music. So for my rock stuff, I use the 5Bs. For my, like, Latin stuff, when I play timbales mixed in with the kit, then I do, like, a 7A, you know, stick.
Now for a full kit, like, if you're going to be working with a band, you know, if, say, you know, for example, you get hired on to do a tour, what specs do you use in full kit, like, for straightforward rock?
Straightforward rock, I guess that would be the band Tito and Tarantula that I played for, and we worked in Europe. And I had a 24-inch kick drum by 16. I had a 13-inch rack tom, 16, 18 floor. So big drums, big cymbals. You know, I went to Zildjian and got, you know, the washiest cymbal. And, I mean, we were rocking out. We bashed, like, you know, it was, you know, we were doing soundtrack songs, because all of Tito's songs are on soundtracks, like Desperado, From Dusk Till Dawn, like all these movies. They're controlled recordings, you know, but live, like, he wants to rock. Like, he came from that world. He wants to fucking turn it up to 11 and just bash, and that's all we did. And I brought that energy. And we had, for that run of 2008, 2009, like, that's what we had. So that's kind of a rock setup that I do, you know.
So now that you currently fronting and leading your own band, Bongaloids, you're a drummer, a percussionist, a well-rounded one, and now you're out front writing the songs, playing guitar and singing. Do you have a lot of requirements for the drummers you work with? Like, you have to play this gauge, I'm looking for this sound, tell me about it.
I think I recently asked my drummer, Alexander Gonzalez, which ride he was using. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, it's the 20-inch K light ride. I'm like, yeah, you got anything heavier? Because I wanted that, like, that Bad Religion ping ride, you know? Right. And he's like, yeah, I think I got one of those, but not right now. I was like, I'll lend you mine, you know? I'm not too picky. I try not to be picky. I try to, like, let everybody control their world. Because that was what people did for me when I came into a situation. You know, I didn't know their music. You know, I'm playing their music. I'm like, what do you need? How can I adapt to this? How can I make you sound good as well as me keep happy as a drummer? You know, some drummers come in showing their chops, and sometimes bands adopt that. You know, sometimes somebody wants a specific part. You know, Money Walk's a good example where I came in early on with him, coming from the Villain, so I was used to punk rock. I come in with him and he's doing like down tempo funk stuff, which just requires a simple beat, like a no fills, nothing, just simple beats. That's something I had to learn, you know,
the discipline
to adapt to his music, because he even told me, he's like, no, don't do all the fills, I don't want a lot of cymbals, just give me a beat. So I had to learn that. So I don't expect a lot from my drummers. I do expect them to know what they're doing. Of course.
But
it's like, I guess that's me and searching, you know, and I haven't really been that picky, you know. People that have been interested, you know, they're like, oh, I'll play, you know, and I'll hear their level, you know, and I won't criticize it. I'll let it happen. I'd have to adapt to what they're doing, you know. If it's
gotcha.
Somebody who still needs a lot of work, you know, I'll work with them and try to, because I can speak their language.
Exactly what I'm saying.
That's one thing that the drummers enjoy, is that I can speak the language with them. But then because I did record the drums on all the records, whatever I did, you know, is not, the next person can't just copy it, because they have a different style of their own, you know. So they're trying their best to try to emulate what I did. And in the end, I'm just like, get the idea and make it yours, you know.
And I think that's, again, another point I was trying to bring to light, was the fact that, you know, if you're behind the kit playing for someone and the guitarist turns around and, you know, who's singing is like, dude, no, I want this, but he doesn't know anything about drums, you're like, what are you talking about? But when you or Dave Grohl turns around to their drummer, yeah, it's like, you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
You get the quick result, and you know.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like, you know the kind of sound that comes off certain sticks that rebound off snare skins, right, and yeah, the kick pedal and a certain dimension of a kick drum. You know, you want a bigger wash, you get the, you know, you want the Bad Religion ping, you want a wider,
yep,
you know. So I think all that comes into play, and you probably are able to get what you want quicker.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, and I've noticed that most of the drummers I've worked with, you know, because I've done some patterns of my own and some songs, you know, it's a challenge for them, which is awesome, you know, because it's awesome. Like, you always want to feel challenged when you're playing, you know, and you also want to, you know, make it easy too on yourself, you know. You don't want to work too hard. So some people, you know, they take their time and take it home and practice, like, you know, I'm still doing that to this day. Even though I'm fronting my own band, I'm still, you know, touring with bands that I have to learn their songs within a day or two. You know, that's like 13 songs, you know.
Well, that's being a professional, though. You're called on.
Right.
And you're conditioned with your eyes and ears and your hands to do that. I mean, some people can't even fathom doing 13 songs in 13 days,
right? No, exactly, yeah.
So tell me, let's move on to guitars. You're playing guitar in the band. Do you have any guitar influences and vocal influences that you want to share?
Not really. I've always been one, I guess, that never paid attention to the name or who was doing it, but knew what I liked. Neil Young was definitely one sound that I liked, and only because I heard him in concert, and that was only like a couple years ago at the Hollywood Bowl, and I was just like, I was blown away by the notes he was playing.
And then you're like, I get it now.
Yeah.
Well, this is why he's great.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and then like, but I had direct influences around me, which were, you know, became family, but it was like David Hidalgo and Luis Perez, who was a drummer in Los Lobos first, but it became a guitarist, and I would listen to his style, totally different style from Dave, you know. And you got Cesar Rosas, that, you know, has a different style. So I was picking up from them, and then I had direct teachings from Louis' son, LP3, Luis Perez III, who was showing me bar chords. And when I was younger as well, I had lessons in guitar. I went to Cal State LA for a morning conservatory, you know. So I was getting schooled here and there, but never took it that far like I did drums. And even on drums, I don't have, like, specific people. I just listen and play along to it, you know. It's like, I mean, I now at this older age, I do pay attention, you know. There's like Steve Gadsden, you know, he's an old funk drummer that's played for all the hit records, you know, and he that's somebody that, you know, I was like, oh yeah, you were who I was listening to. I just didn't know your name or even knew who your band was, but I knew the style, you know, and would try to emulate, you know. So definitely, you know, I've been influenced by a lot of people. I just don't, I never really like to get into specifics. I don't know. I have, there's many friends that I have like, oh, you know, I got this guy and this guy, I play like this guy. And maybe that's, for me, that's something that keeps my mind fresh, where I don't have that on me where like I'm trying to sound like, you know, Ace Frehley or whatever. It's like I'm just doing my thing, doing what I think sounds good, you know. And I finally had to buy a better guitar, because with the one my mom bought me, you know, it's like kind of flimsy. And I was like I'd look at Louis's guitar and he had nice heavy Gibsons, you know, and I'm just like, okay, I gotta find something, you know. And I was on tour with Tito and Tarantula, and they were endorsed by Duesenberg Guitars, and I was able to buy one through them. And you know, it's, you know, I still couldn't tell you what the pickups are, you know. I couldn't tell you what kind of wood it is. It's half hollow body, but it sounds good, you know. That's one thing that I like, you know. I've plugged it into the amp and I get a good sound, you know, and makes me happy, you know.
And lastly, articulate what the sound of your band Bongaloids is. I mean, if you had to file it in a record store, where would it be filed? And tell us a little bit about the sound, because I know it's, you do all the writing, lyrics, yeah, and music.
What is it, like tropical punk?
Tropical?
Punk tropical with a little bit of alterna cumbia. Man, my sound, I don't know, comes from what all the influences and experiences I've had playing music live. You know, I started in a punk band, went to a ska band, Latin jazz ska band, excuse me, learned the Latin side of things. Then I joined the Beastie Boys, was a hip-hop side of things, as well as punk rock and percussion. And then I'd come back home and I'd play with groups, local groups like Gava, you know, that were mixing ska and cumbia, you know. And I mean, even the band Yeska that I was in, like mid-90s, we mixed Latin jazz and ska, and we turned it into salsa. So I was learning salsa. So all of that kind of mixed into my sound. And, you know, I was a big fan of Jawbreaker. So it's like, you know, that was a big influence. You know, that I have songs that sound like that. I have songs like, I don't even know what they sound like. I always kind of hate describing my music. I'm just like, just listen to it. But I always want to, like, no, I would like to describe it. But punk rock, hip-hop, I'm a big fan of hip-hop. In the 80s, I used to buy Dr. Dre's mixtapes at Rhodium Swap Meet. So there's a very, you know, strong hip-hop influence in my heart. And I did a cumbia on the record. You know, I even did some electro stuff. You know, I was into, like, drum and bass and stuff like that. So I was just, everything that I've been exposed to over the years just kind of morphed into what the Bongaloid sound is. And there is no category, and I kind of like it that there is, because the feedback that I'm getting from people is, like, they like the mix. They like it that it keeps changing, you know, and there's something fresh every time. But you would go look back and be like, man, if I was signed to a label, they would have to, like, kind of narrow me down. They're like, okay, well, are you going to do cumbia? Are you going to do the punk rock? Or are you going to do the hip-hop? Let's narrow it down, you know, and then you would have a hard time trying to be, you know, what other people wanted you to sound like other than what I want to sound like, and I'm sounding like what I want to sound like. And, you know, so far the feedback has been amazing. My record's about to come out. I just got the covers for it. I'm putting it out myself. I did a Kickstarter for it, got funded, you know, had the support of people who bought the record, pre-bought the record without even knowing what it was going to sound like. You know, I don't have any videos out there. I don't have anything prior to the release. So this is going to be my debut release. You know, coming from, you know, touring for all these years, I want to do this on my own and share that sound with people, share, you know, what I'm doing. And still right now, I'm trying to think of what I can call it, and I have no idea.
Well done, well put. And Fredo Ortiz, thank you so much for being a part of the NAMM 14 Los Angeles Nista coverage episode.
Alrighty, thanks, brother.
Hey, welcome back to the 112th episode of Los Angeles Nista. I'm the show creator, producer, and host, Eddie Solis. And my in-studio guest is the founder of Vagina Guitars, Andrew Miller. Andrew, you holding up all right?
Yeah, I'm doing fine.
Awesome, man. I'm excited. You know, you went there to figure out, you know, who you're going to use for your hardware and try to make a deal like everyone else. I mean, NAMM is about business, first and foremost, National yeah. Association of Music Merchants. And in the preliminary episode we did, the preview, I took my time to really try to coherently explain and articulate what it is. It's more than just getting, you know, an autograph from Steve I or Gene Simmons or something like that. It's about, you know, doing business in that industry, manufacturers, distributors, independent retail, major retail, sheet music, teachers. It means a lot to all those people. This is their livelihood. So you, as a manufacturer, guitar manufacturer, you went and you were looking for different vendors to try to strike a deal so you could get wholesale hardware.
Yeah.
How difficult is that?
Well, it's not really difficult because I'm a real business. I have all the paperwork and everything.
Right. You're legit, obviously.
But the, I kind of had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder when I went there because I had a supplier that just irritated me every time I talked to them, just bad customer service.
So right.
The number one thing was like, all right, replace this supplier.
Right.
That was the first thing I did. It was productive for me because that was why I needed to be there. It's just that the whole van thing kind of sidetracked me because we were too busy eating lunch in a rental car across the parking lot. Like, what the hell is going on, you know? But overall, yeah, it was pretty productive.
Very cool. As far as the feedback from your guitar company, it just seems like people are uptight. There's this whole PC politically correct thing, and music's supposed to be about self-expression. It's art. And you actually received complaints from people through email about the name.
Oh, yeah.
And what struck me about that statement is that you have, the name Vagina Guitars, it's just, that's a real word. It's not, it's not a slang for that word.
It doesn't mean anything else.
It's, that's the real world, the word. And the thing about it is, I saw photos of like women, females, taking pictures against the van, having fun with it.
Yeah.
Not taking it too serious, just having fun. And that's what you wanted to do. I wanted you to state this. You're tired personally of seeing guitar manufacturers with people's names on it, literally.
Well, you know what it is? It's always some guy's name that you never even heard of, and he's using his name as if you're supposed to know it or something. For example, like, it reminds me of on Sunset, there's a liquor store that says whatever, whatever is liquors. And I can tell he's like trying to be famous for any reason. So he's like trying to be known for this liquor store, but it's the same thing. It's like, you know, whatever guitars. And it just makes me think of some failed guitar player who just wants his 15 minutes. So he sells some crap guitars and, you know, let me put my name on it because then people know who I am. Yeah, whatever. I don't care.
So you said, I'm not going to put my name on it. Let's just have fun. And you came up, the first thing that came into your mind was?
Actually, I didn't even think I wouldn't put my name on it. As soon as I made a guitar, I said, I want to write Vagina on the top of it. And that was it. There was no other question. Yeah, done. That was it. And somebody said, well, what else did you think of? No, I didn't think of anything else because that is just, it's the best name. What else would I use?
Gotcha. So let's take a look at one of your Vagina guitars. Right,
this is one of the first ones I made. I like to keep them simple. I don't like plastic. That's the main thing. I don't like plastic. I try to eliminate as much as I can.
That's great.
And this one was like just a straight up FU guitar. It doesn't have a volume. It's just you plug it in.
No volume. I love that.
Yeah, all the way up, all the time. That's it. Nice and simple, white. I did have a little bit of a bucket head thing going on with this. I won't lie.
Are you a bucket head fan?
Yeah, well, when I was like, when Buckethead was starting out was when I was in my like late teens going to shows and stuff in the Bay Area. I remember seeing him in Deli Creeps. He actually didn't even have the white Les Pauls yet. But it's kind of what gave me the idea of the white. That and I don't like crazy colors anyway. I don't want to get stuck with some orange guitar trying to sell it.
Right. 13 years later.
Yeah, 13 years later. Hey, you want this guitar with a handle in it? Yeah, what am I going to do with that?
Right. So as far as the guitar that you just showed us, there's no volume knob, hardly any plastic. So tell me what you do personally to try to eliminate as much plastic from a guitar. So where do you start with that?
Oh, first thing I do is throw them humbucker rings in the trash. I don't like any of the thrush rod cover and all that. And even the knobs. I have my friend make billet aluminum knobs because I don't even want plastic knobs. For some reason, every guitar has the same three shapes. You got the Strat shape, you got the Les Paul clear, half clear, whatever things. And then the metal ones. But I don't know, the metal ones are all full of plastic now anyway. So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as I want to talk about your baritones again. The whole Les Paul baritone, mm-hmm. you particularly you know, spoke about that, how you want that to be. It has a longer neck, right?
Well, actually, what I did was I sank the neck deeper into the body, and it made the cutout deeper. That way, it still fits in the same size case, and instead of tuning it to E, you're tuning to A. A or B, whatever, you know. But it's just as comfortable as a regular size Les Paul, but you have way more, you know, if you want that, the ringing notes of the low notes. Because if you just tune down, you just get the vibration. But yeah, that's what I tried to do. I didn't want it looking like a Les Paul bass either, because those always look, retarded? yeah.
Now, what about basses? You think you'll make any basses?
I will, but see, I started with classic shapes that I like for the guitars.
Sure.
As far as basses, I just don't like how they look most of the time. I'm not a huge fan of P basses and jazz basses. All the high-end stuff. Well, you know what? That's the problem, too, with basses. There's nothing in the middle. It's either some cheap bass or it's something that's like $9,000, and there's nothing in the middle. And as much as it is, it started as a hobby, I do have to make some money on it. So it's kind of hard at that middle ground. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with them yet. I got to find some kind of something interesting or design something. It just hasn't popped in my head yet. It will.
Right. So besides your three classic shapes, what else is cooking as far as your forthcoming? I mean, where are you going to go after these three?
Well, I have like my variation of a Telecaster. It's not that traditional because I'm just not into Telecasters, but people keep asking for them, so I got to do something with it.
Oh, wow.
Let's see. I think I'm going to do more with the Vs. I'm not sure yet how I want to do it. My wife keeps telling me to make some kind of shape that looks like our emblem, but I don't know about that. I think it's a little too pointy.
So, I mean, that's that balance that you have to find between too pointy and too round, right?
Yeah, too pointy looks like a weapon, looks stupid. Too round starts looking too feminine, then it's not metal anymore. You can't be called vagina and be too feminine, because then I gotta sell Daisy Rock guitars. I'm not doing that.
So no Daisy Rock guitars at all, ever?
No. I don't need something that looks like a sunflower.
Tell me about your music.
About my music? Music's just angry.
Oh, yeah?
And not as angry as it used to be, because I'm getting older. You know, I'm just bitching about different stuff. Where the hell are my keys? You know,
okay.
It's just a matter of stuff.
Gotcha. But your personal taste, a little bit about you.
My personal taste, to give you an example, I didn't care about Kiss and all that at signing autographs at NAMM, but I did have to talk to Kerry King.
Really?
You know, oh, yeah. That's in my... When I was 15 years old, I saw Slayer, and I wasn't the same ever since. I mean, I don't even know how I got permission to go. It was like on a Wednesday night in San Francisco. I had to take the train there.
You got there.
For some reason, I convinced my parents to let me go on a school night. You know, so yeah, I don't know how that worked out.
Right.
But who knows?
Maybe. So let's talk about overall you walking through the halls of NAMM, through the perspective of an independent business, guitar manufacturer and a musician. What do you think? I mean, was this your first NAMM?
No, it wasn't. I went years ago. When was it? Probably 6 or 7 years ago. And it was exactly the same. The rock stars still looked old.
Yeah.
I recognize a lot less people this time.
Okay.
But it was the same thing, and that was the other thing. I think that's why the van got attention, was because it was the exact same thing I saw 7 years ago. It's like nobody's doing anything different. I saw that the Ernie Ball booth, they had some people dressed like circus stuff. You know, it was kind of interesting. They had like a game to play or something like that. But it seemed to me like they were the only ones making any effort. Everybody else just had their guys playing leads and making, you know, sex faces at me when I'm walking by. It didn't make me want to buy anything.
Sex faces.
Well, pretty much. You know, the guitar face.
Yeah, the guitar face, right? That's weird. Is that a weird thing?
Well, it is weird when I'm standing in line to see Geezer Butler. Those are the only two people I cared about. I want to see Kerry King and I want to see Geezer Butler. But standing in line, I'm like right across from this guy who's playing leads. I'm the only one paying attention. He's staring dead in my eyes, making these faces. It's like, I'm trying to like appreciate what you're doing, but that's not going to work, man. I tried to switch with my wife in line, make her face him, but she wouldn't take any part of it.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. Personally, I had a great experience at NAMM. You know, my intent was, as a media outlet with SkidRowStudios.com doing this show, Los Angeles Nista, You know, to go and capture some interviews, which I did, that were installed. We, you know, we just heard with Bill from Macedon and Fredo Ortiz from Beastie Boys and Bongaloids. And the other part of that was to go as an artist, an endorsed artist. I work with a pickup company called Seymour Duncan. And you know how it is when, you know, when you're able, you have a relationship and then you go, you're working with this company and then you go see the people, you meet them. And that
it does help to see the people in person.
Yeah, and it was nothing but a great experience. The Seymour Duncan family, you know, Craig Costigan, Boomer, Maricela Juarez, and Kathy Duncan. It was great to meet with all of them, and, you know, they were just so reinforcing and generous and, you know, like family. It was great. That was one thing I had to do as an artist, and it was great. So, I mean, for me, I did 2 days, not four. You did all four.
Yeah, we had to be there all four. Don't get me wrong. I was saying that people weren't doing much, but we did enjoy it. But we were tired. We were beat by the fourth day. But, you know, we had to leave the van there. People enjoyed it. I mean, we enjoyed watching people buy it. And it was like zombies around that thing. They just, by the fourth day, there were beer cans under the van and empty cigarette packs. I mean, I saw people were actually using it as a landmark. Like, hey, pick me up by the vagina van.
Like an anchor destination.
Yeah.
So tell me about, now here's what I don't get. Are people really that bored where they're going to write you a complaint email about the name of your guitar company?
Yes.
Okay, tell me what some of these dudes said. Like, let's hear this.
Okay, well, the first one I got really threw me off because, okay, first of all, I'm not used to, I wasn't expecting all the attention that we got. So that already threw me off. Then I ended up getting this email from some guy who was demanding credentials. And he put me in one of those positions where it's like, why don't you explain this and this and this to me? And if you don't respond, don't respond unless you have the proper and acceptable proof, blah, 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 blah. But basically it was like one of those no-win situations. And my first reaction is the union carpenter into me, where I just wanted to rip into him. But, I had to bite my tongue. It's like, I don't even respond. I'll just post it on Facebook and complain about him there. I'm not going to write back to this guy. Because I'm still, you know, vagina still has its hymen. We're young. We can't do crazy stuff right now because no one has any information. They're going to judge us by anything we do.
Sure.
So I have to really watch myself, and I've never been like that before. So it's a little bit of a pain. Like, I don't want to. I want to rip into everybody who talks shit to me. But the bottom line is, it's weird because the only people who complain are men. You would think there'd be some uptight, you know, woman who's like, that's disgusting. But none of that.
The women are taking pictures by the van.
They're crazier.
Yeah.
The guys stand next to the van, but the girls are like posing with their face in each other. And it's ridiculous. One girl had her foot behind her head and... it's pretty crazy. One lady was posing her kids. She had her kids leaned up against the van. It's the whole thing was like that.
That is funny. The fact that people are really offended for whatever reason.
I mean, there wasn't a lot. Actually, it was low, but
it was low.
It bothered me just because I wasn't used to it.
Right.
I don't know.
I hear you. I hear you. Now let's talk about 2014. This is wrap it up here. You're going to be filling the demand. People are asking for your guitars.
Yeah, please be patient with me. Serious. The company's very, very small. I try to get back to every email as soon as I can. But, I'm pretty hammered with stuff right now. It's hard. So be patient with me. I will get back to you.
Now as far as... line goes, I just want to, you know, articulate to people, you know, you got stuff coming in, you're going to be putting that together.
Yes.
It's, you know, be patient. It's you. You're the guy.
Yes, pretty much me and my wife, and she's just now showing interest because she realizes that people actually like it.
Awesome.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be fun. That's the bottom line. People, they're too serious about things. I wanted to have something fun that you can enjoy. That's why I think people enjoyed it was because it's like adolescent humor anyway. It makes you kind of feel childish and giggle because it's like before you were even swearing, you thought this was crazy. And that's all it is. Just have some fun. Yeah, if somebody is uptight about it, there's something wrong.
Right. And you know what? Good luck to you, man.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here as an in-studio guest for the NAMM wrap-up. Good luck to you, and I look forward to talking to you a lot more in the future.
Cool.
And trying out your product. And just stay in touch. Everyone out there, thank you for checking out the 112th episode of Los Angeles Nista. Thank you.